Show Me the Way, episode 19, The High-End Advisor. In this episode, we talk with David Ennenbach about his life experiences, including his involvement with helping folks with their businesses and preparing for sale. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fane LLP about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exit. I'm your host, Dave Sider. Joining me on today's show is David Ennenbach, who I've known well over 30 years, maybe even longer than that, Dave, here in Kansas City. Dave has a very interesting background helping very high net worth individuals, and he has as well a multitude of experiences in helping all types of businesses prepare for their eventual sale. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dave. I'm excited to visit with you and catch up a little bit.
Yeah, thank you. I'm with you on that page. Let's start. Give us a little flavor of your background. It's always important, I think, for the listeners to find out, you know, where the guests come from. Where were you born? Where were you raised?
In Columbia, Missouri. For your Midwest listeners, that's the home of Missouri Tigers. And I'm not afraid to say that despite being born and lived there for 12 years, I'm a Kansas Jayhawk and proud of it.
And when did you graduate from the university?
1981. I might want to clarify.
Just in case anybody was really concerned about it. Yeah. And I majored in accounting. And I take it you majored in accounting, right?
I did major in accounting, yep.
You're a CPA. Where did you go to work?
Out of school, I joined what at the time was a 18-person local CPA firm by the name of Donnelly, Miners, and Jordan. I became an accountant and wanted to be a CPA because I had an uncle who was a CPA, a partner at Pete Marwick and Mitchell at the time, now KPMG. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he drove a convertible and he looked successful and he was bright. I remember as a teenager going, I don't know what Uncle Dick does, but I want to be like that. So on my SAT application or desired major, I put accounting. I took accounting classes and I got out of school. And so as I got ready to graduate, I talked to him about options. And, you know, he shared with me that the Big Eight at the time had been wonderful, but he had lived in Puerto Rico, he'd been to Miami, he'd been in New York, been to St. Louis, now back to Tampa. Although he was a partner, he, you know, kind of didn't feel like a business owner. There was 1,600 of them, kind of not a big deal. And he said, you know what, you ought to take a look at the large local. So a little research. We had two great local firms in Kansas City at the time. And I ended up going to work for one of them, and it turned out really good. I spent 20 years there. Started as a boy accountant, where I didn't know a thing. My first day, I was just my spreadsheet going, I wish I had gone to class harder or something. I probably wasn't ready at all. Anyway, over 20 years, went from boy accountant to managing partner and enjoyed every single day of it.
You know, I'm going to ask you this question. I'm not asking it of anybody in their particular, based upon their particular degree, and I ask this about myself. Are you a typical accountant?
No, I'm told no, but I think that's more right. I'm not the stereotypical accountant is what they mean.
Right, right. You know, that's exactly it.
Stereotype. It's the green eye shades and the armbands and the 10 key. And, you know, it's kind of like the old joke of, how do you tell an introverted accountant from an extroverted accountant? The extrovert looks at your shoes when he's talking to you.
Yes. Yeah. Truly, sir. I get the same approach, and I take that as a compliment because you can see it bigger than your particular degree. So you made a jump. I think this is because you're more than an accountant. You made a jump from DMJ. What did you do?
Purely kind of just the way the stars aligned. I always thought I would just retire there.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Industry then and now, the partner retirement plan is non-booked, non-paid for, non-funded, deferred comp. So you got to get somebody in younger than you, keep the firm moving, and pay you out over time. We had reached a kind of a top-heavy position where the numbers were going to be really hard to pull off. Kind of out of the blue, we were approached by probably the first consolidator, you know, people wanting to consolidate CPA firms.
Right.
gosh, it checked a lot of boxes for it. We sold the firm to him. It was H&R Block, who's now exited the business, but we sold the firm. And I stuck around for 2 full years after, but everything had changed. You know, nothing had changed, but everything changed. And it was no longer entrepreneurial. You know, we were, you know, at that point, kind of mid-level execs of a publicly traded company with quarterly earnings and a whole different business model. And I had a client and a good friend who, you know, introduced me to an outfit looking for someone to come in and learn the business, grow the business, buy the business. So I poked around with that, decided it'd be a fun career change. I'm a golfer as my hobby. And this was a business that managed professional athletes, which was golfers, 2 Hall of Famers in the stable. It was kind of a, what I call a peek behind the curtain, to use a Wizard of Oz metaphor about how the business of golf works and these folks. And it was really fun and sexy and challenging for a while. 4 years into it, I think I'd kind of met all the new people I wanted to meet and kind of had a different idea of something I'd want to do. So 2005, I quit my job, went home, had some business cards and letterhead printed up and launched a website and went out trying to build a new business.
And I've been doing that ever since.
First year was a lean year. I had a life lesson that I learned as CPAs, law firms probably do the same thing. Take a partner retreat every couple of years. And one of the things we would always do, we'd look at our clients and we'd classify them as A, B, C, D clients. D client, low margin, doesn't use a lot. If you can just get the staff to do all the work and never spend any time with them, you'd be happy to keep them, but we don't want to fire them because they, you know, we have a relationship with them. C clients, you know, they buy a little bit more, they pay a little better. You know, maybe if you can see them once every couple of years, you'll tolerate them. B clients, you know, if you can see them once a year and have a manager or supervisor handle it, that's great. But your A clients, they bought a lot of your services, they paid good fees, they didn't take unreasonable tax positions, they didn't beat up your staff, they pay it on time. Man, you want to try to see them 4 times a year and make sure you keep them.
Or a week. Yeah. Right.
So anyway, I started my business with that in the front of my mind, not even the back of my mind. And I'm like, well, I'm going to weed D clients out at the client acceptance level. And I said, well, why have C clients? Because they're not really what you're building. And I got a little carried away and I said, I don't even want any B clients.
That's good for you.
The time I miss an A opportunity, because I'm fooling around with a B client, you ought to just shoot me. So my first year, I turned away a lot of B, C, and D opportunities. You know, I was burning through savings and, you know, trying to just kind of stay in business. But it worked out. It took me a year and a half, but I got 2 A clients. You know, in my business, those are what we call the ultra affluent or ultra high net worth. And, you know, it worked.
Good for you. You have, it reminds me of a guy I interviewed for the podcast, Joe Sewer, who developed a plan in about 2003 and executed on it and got to the result at once. It sounds like you had the same phenomenon. Here's my plan. I'm going to go execute. And you've been highly successful at it, working with the people you want to work at, going in the direction you've always wanted to go.
Yep. I'm doing what I want to do, the way I want to do it, for the kinds of people I want to do it for.
So let's talk about that. What is your strategy? Obviously, you know who you want to work with. What is your strategy as far as how you help your clients? And I mean, I know you've got obviously the accounting, the financial background, but is there kind of a big picture strategy, maybe even a holistic approach?
Well, it's absolutely holistic. Popular name for, you know, what I do in our industry is a family office, and we are a multi-client family office. So the family office was started for the Carnegies, the Mellons, the Rothschilds, had so much wealth and work and complexity. They had to hire people to manage it. The next level of wealth down need those services, but not full time. So, you know, some number of families will share a family office. So that's what I've got. Multi for me is 3. We manage 3 ultra affluent families. Our average client investable net worth, call it $100 million in round numbers. So investment management is the core.
Mm-hmm.
The spokes around that are financial administration, which is bill pay, asset titling. We work with the estate planners on developing and then executing estate plan, which is getting things titled right. We spend a lot of time on intergenerational work, preparing the next generation to inherit, manage, perpetrate the family wealth. We work with the tax people on tax planning and execution, household help. Every now and again, there used to be a politician who would be disqualified because not filed 941s on the maid, right?
Right.
You know, it's a rule, and yeah, you know, it's not that hard to do. We help clients decide whether to lease or fractionally own or just charter their jet travel. They're all charitable, so we help them with the donor advised fund versus private foundation decision, execution, administration. And then, Dave, a whole bucket of what we just call elsewhere not classified.
Right.
You know, right. Comes up, you figure it out. I think I learned in my first career, I'm an okay marketer. You know, I think I'm pretty good, I guess, at increasing market share. What I learned is increasing market share is really inefficient. You're competing, you're bidding, you're cost competitive, you win some, you lose some. I figure out a much more efficient way to grow revenue is by increasing customer share. The more time I spent with my customers, the more problems I could identify, the more I could solve, the more I could charge. So in my business, I have an interaction with every one of my clients every day. It's phone call, it's email, it's a text, it's a report, it's a question, it's a meeting. But I found that the more time I spend with them, the more work I have, the more valuable I am, the deeper my roots and that relationship are.
You have your own podcast marketing sales presentation in front of you, it sounds like. I mean, I'm serious. I mean, you've obviously captured something that has eluded a lot of different people over the years in the professions that we're in. How do you help them grow their business? Or are all these businesses essentially liquidated or monetized, and then you're helping with the investment portfolio?
I have one client with an ongoing business today. The other two have monetized, and they're in three completely different industries.
Interesting.
But, you know, I think growing your business, whatever your business is simple, but of course it's hard. And it's simple because, you know, job one is know your business. Who am I? What am I good at? Who's my best customer? Where can I make money? You know, kind of the age old, if you're going to be the low price leader, you better be the low cost leader. Walmart.
Yes.
Can charge low prices because they buy right. They build lower per square foot than any other retail operation in the world. And that's where they're strong. They can't compete against Bloomingdale's, mm-hmm. but they're in their spot. And Bloomingdale's can't compete on price against Walmart, but they knew who they are. I've read a lot of business books over the years, and my favorite one is called The Goal. And I can't remember the author. Huh. But the essence of it is, you know, the popular term during the 90s, I think, was SWOT analysis.
Strengths, yes, weaknesses, yes, yes, threats. Yes.
The premise of The Goal, overstated for simplicity and the time of your podcast, is when you do your SWOT analysis, try to figure out something that's important that you're really not great at and make yourself great at it. Right. Right. You're not going to turn your best thing into your worst thing, but find a weakness and turn it into a strength.
Man.
Lather, rinse, repeat. Find another thing you're not great at and become great at it. You know, continuous improvement was the buzzword of some other decade. But that concept, I think, works well in any business. Whatever, your attorney, mm-hmm. your financial advisor, your manufacturer, your rep. Find the things that are important. Find the one you're the least great at and make yourself great at it.
So have you helped people get their companies ready to sell or been yes. involved in the process? Share with us the good and the bad. And I want to say the bad, the difficulties, the disappointments. Share with us what you've experienced and some of the advice you would give to people. Because I'm going to sit back and listen. I want to learn from you on this.
Okay, you're going to have to cut me off because that's...
No. No.
The things I've learned, the first thing I would say is probably universal in the 20, 25 transactions I've been involved with is they all would have been served by more planning. You know, roughly half of the transactions I've been closely involved with as an advisor, buyer, or seller resulted from a out of left field offer or discussion. You know, you got a business cruising along, things are great. Right. And all of a sudden there's this, wait, somebody wants to buy this thing?
There's an LOI shows up on your desk.
wait a minute here. Oh gosh, if I had more time to get ready, I could have cleaned this up, cleaned that up. And you can normalize an income statement a little bit. Some of the things you can do better at, you can do a little bit better at. But universally, I'd say people don't plan for it soon enough. Now, succession planning is kind of like estate planning. You know, we know we're all going to die someday.
Right.
Way far from now, and we'll do our estate planning closer to that. Well, obviously, the sooner you start estate planning, the more efficient estate plan you can have. But the sooner you start kind of planning for succession, whether that's internal, external, outside, but without a transaction, the better you can do. The planning part, and I actually was able to get a couple of the business I was involved with to do it because they had an idea that someday we might want to do something. I had them do a business valuation. You get a CVA, Certified Valuation Analyst, come in and do a business valuation. They're not cheap, but they're not crazy expensive. I think for a normal business, $10,000 to $20,000 will get you a Certified Valuation Report. And right in the report, they will tell you the limitations on a better value. They'll look at market multiples for your business in this time, and they will tell you what you need to do to increase your value.
Right.
If you have customer concentration, you can decide, do I want to change that? If there's no middle management, could I build that? If my margins trail the industry I'm in, you can figure out a way to cut your costs or increase your price. But they will give you a roadmap to what do I got to do to increase my business value? It's cheap.
Well, to kind of extrapolate on that, it always seems to me that either someone's trying to manipulate a business to see how much money they can get out of it, or they're manipulating the business to try to figure out how to improve it at its highest level to sell. And the intersection between the two, sometimes there is none.
That's the delicate balance.
How do you counsel people on that? Because you can't say, okay, abandon all prior efforts. You know, I say, okay, let's get the condo out of the business. You know, let's right. bring you back to market value on what you're really worth, and you can still get a lot of money out of the dividends and distributions. And by the way, do you think a Ferrari is really a company car? I mean, I don't know. Let's go to NetJet. I mean, how do you handle people when they say you got to get maybe a little skinny is what the word I use.
Well, the counterbalance to all of that is your mission. What is your goal? What's your trying to accomplish here? Strategic planning, you know, we all were remanded to the boardroom to come up with a mission statement. And I'm not talking about your mission statement. I'm talking about your mission.
Yeah. Very good.
Our group of owners, what are you here for? What are we doing?
Yeah.
And it's not always maximizing profit, right? It could be building something for next generation.
Right.
It could be solving a problem. It could be winning a best in class. But without that, all the rest is really difficult to evaluate.
Right.
Now, entrepreneurs generally are great idea people. They have above average intellect. They have way off the chart drive, right?
Yes. I call them from a learner's from strategic coach. They call it quick start.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll get on something and run to the races with it. Yeah. You're right.
So those people know it, but it's kind of back in the gray matter. So you got to milk it a little bit. You got to work them through it and challenge them and ask them to state it a different way. But over time, you can get it out of the back of their mind to their forefront. And while that sometimes can be difficult, it can be sensitive, it can be a moving target. I cannot think of an example where I've done that and the client wished we hadn't. They're all like, God, that helped. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've got a beacon. Every decision I make, if I'm moving towards my beacon, is a good decision. And all this other stuff are something shiny. Don't get distracted by the something shiny over there.
Squirrel.
A quarter, a spinning top, a juggler. There's a beacon on the horizon. Let's make sure we're staying on track, moving towards that.
Do you see yourself doing it by way of sending out a number of year criteria, a dollars and cents criteria, a capture of a certain part of the market criteria? Or is it, frankly, does it just depend on the business and the individual's objectives?
It depends. And there are objective and subjective qualifiers.
Yep.
Yeah.
Where are people, in your estimation? I mean, my experience is not all deals get done. You get an LOI only means that
Yeah, we got something to talk about. That's what an LOI means to me.
Some of them don't work out.
That's right.
Why? What has been your experience as to why they don't work out, the acquisition?
Well, because they're not right. I mean, at the end of the day, the right deals get done.
Right.
You know, I think sometimes people are a little quick to get to the LOI because it's, you know, it's a road marker. Yeah. Oh, yep. That's a mile marker now. Let's do an LOI.
Yeah.
Before that, you haven't asked some questions. You haven't identified some important points of a transaction or life post-transaction. And you get into it and you realize, we are too far apart to bridge that gap. And, you know, I'm sure like you have seen post-LOI deals die and get reborn.
Right.
I've seen that on probably half the deals I've been through. One party or the other says, you know what, this has been fun, but obviously this isn't going to work. I wish you a lot of luck. And everybody goes back and heart rates settle down. And you know what, I had a new idea, a fresh approach about solving that. Right. Let's get back together.
You know, to your point, sometimes there's somebody waiting in the wings as well. I did one a couple of years ago, right at the beginning of COVID, where I said, this is not going to go forward. I'm going to tell you, I got all the signs here. But yet by the end of the year, we found another way with a different group. You know, see, I never know. Okay. The one thing I ask people to do, and I ask you to comment about this, if you're really sincere about these people, go do a 4-day retreat. Okay. Go get to know them, because I there are different ways to look at business. If you're going to get into bed with a private equity group, and there's nothing wrong with that, but if this was by way of lineal descendancy, your business from father or grandfather, you're going to find different cultural objectives, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But you need to figure out that you may be looking at this business entirely differently, and is that acceptable to you?
I've had to tell every one of my seller clients multiple times. Let's be clear. At the end of this negotiation, they're going to give you some stock or a pot of money of some combination, and you're going to give them the company. All right. They don't get to tell you what to do with your money, but you don't get to tell them what to do with their company.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay? They're going to make you recognize it in 3 to 5 years. And if you're not okay with that, we ought to stick around and run it into the ground.
And as one of my clients say, when that issue comes up, when he bought them, you'll always ask him, did the check clear? I'm just wondering. I mean, to your point, how do you deal with someone, male or female, who's been there for 40 years and it's over and they can't give it up? It was one of the speakers in a podcast a month or so ago where she talks about the seller's journey and how to deal with that and the psychology behind it. How do you deal with that? Or how have you dealt with that?
We talk about options. The first question is, before the transaction, have you gathered enough assets to retire the way you want to retire? All right. If the answer to that is no, we got to do a transaction.
Right.
All right. If the answer to that is yes, we don't have to do a transaction. You know, you can leave more to charity or pay more state taxes or leave more to your kids, but you're set. So then it becomes, how important to you are these non-financial parts of a transaction? Most closely held businesses, the entrepreneur and his company are almost inseparable.
Correct.
I try to help clients separate. That's not who you are. That's not you. That was a business that you started or grew or ran or something, but that's not you. And I think an important part of that, which is, the important thing is always the most difficult thing, right, Dave? The important thing, which is the most difficult thing, is now what?
Right.
All right. I'm going to sell. I'm going to have a little consulting period. And when that's over, when I get up, what do I put on and where do I go? And if you don't have the answer to that question, you shouldn't sell yet.
Yeah. You're not ready to go. I counsel clients to go, let's invent something bigger than what you have. Because I've learned over the years, if you have something to go to as opposed to run from, it's done.
Yep.
But I feel bad for the people that they don't have what's next. And it's really, really tough, because you're right. They can't detach themselves. And I don't blame them. I said, it's always tough. It always seems like as one of my clients said, the first year is recess. after many, many years of running a business.
All this time. Wow.
Wow. This is great. And then you got to start figuring out. So I'm with you on that. That page is another concept I've learned called the retirement trick, where you sit down with your client and ask him to write out everything he wants to do in retirement. And Dave, if the list is good and complete, you go, you're ready to sell.
Yep.
Because that's what you should be doing. You're just not doing it now.
Right.
In your experience, how much time should one spend with the significant other? Because the spouse is, especially with a lot of, you know, family-owned businesses, has equally as much invested. A little bit more separation.
Yep.
But how do you coach the spouse? Because oftentimes, in my experiences, there is a driver, but at the same time, most of these family-owned businesses, mom and dad are really running it, because mom has to deal with dad whether she's in the business or not. And a lot of times, you know, or some of the times, mom is actually involved in the business, most notably as a bookkeeper or doing something else. And I don't mean to demean spouses, but they bleed equally as much. So how do you deal with that side of the ledger? Because they have different objectives. Can't say it about everybody. Each person has their own objectives.
Right. Well, just the way the cards have fallen, the vast majority of my sellers have been the old-fashioned, or we used to call it traditional roles, where the father made the bread and the mom cooked it and served it and raised the kids. You know, if I could kind of mold all those into one couple, the mom, the wife is ready.
Right.
Shared her husband with this business, second love interest, for most or all of their marriage, and she's ready for some more time.
Yes.
Now, there's a popular kind of joke that comes out that after the transaction and, you know, husband is home all the time, or the wife says at some point, you know what, I married you for better or worse, but not for lunch.
You gotta
go somewhere.
Anywhere.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
This is my space.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to go, but you can't stay here. There's no question about that. At the end of the day, in looking back, what has been the most exciting part of your job as far as helping people, you know, through the process of selling their business and or monetizing their business and then going beyond? What is most rewarding for you?
That is, of all the questions you've asked me, that is the crystal clear one. For me, it's the analogy I use is entrepreneurs, business is building a ice cream sundae. They work hard, they build the cone, they figure out how many of what flavors of ice cream, they put the nuts, the sprinkles, the caramel or chocolate glaze on it. And the final transaction is the cherry on top. So what I'm trying to help them do is put the cherry on top of their sundae. They started it. They grew it. They improved it. They sold it. Cherry on top. We're done. We have a sundae. Now what?
Mm-hmm.
So the cherry on top part is the moment. That's the thing. You get the best champagne you can find. You toast. If you're a cigar smoker, you get the best. You know, that's a celebration. But I'm probably as proud of helping clients have prepared for the now what part of it.
Right.
You close on Friday and Monday morning you woke up. Let's say you're the first company that never had a consulting or, you know, kind of carryover period. You wake up on Monday morning and you don't know what to put on because you don't know where you're going and you don't know what you're going to do. So I've helped my clients prepare for that day.
That's cool. Good for you. I don't know very many people who do that.
David, I was probably 5 years old, boy accountant, and I had, you know, staff accountant responsibility for a little account, a small business entrepreneur that sold his business. We used to have happy hour, you know, all of us kids at the CPA firm at this same bar. And the first Friday after that, I saw this guy who was a gentleman and a faith-based guy and just a solid individual at the bar by himself having a couple of martinis. He was there again the next Friday. The third Friday, I had to call a cab for him. We didn't have Ubers back then, but I had to kind of pour him into a cab. And that was my first bright light. This guy didn't have what next answered.
Right. Exactly.
His whole career, he had this business, he sold it. And his Friday afternoon was drink himself into peace, I guess you'd call it, but he wasn't at peace. So again, that left an impression on me that entrepreneurs are they're so closely intertwined with their business.
Yes.
When they get rid of it, they're lost. They can be lost if they haven't planned. So, I mean, as a 25-year-old kid, that's so long ago now, I don't want to do the math for you, but that stuck with me.
That's interesting because we both have that same belief pattern. Okay. What are the two or three things you would say to anyone? Only two or three things about what to do when you think it's time to sell your business.
I would say step one is to make a list of the most important things for you. All right. And, you know, if you've been in this, you're not surprised, but if you're kind of starting to look at this stuff, step one isn't always maximize sales price.
Right.
I'm a great believer that any transaction, there's two things, price and terms.
Right.
One side gets control one, is I guess control the other. If you want to control price, you can get the best price, but you have to give up on some terms you might otherwise like. So cash or stock or capital gain assets versus ordinary assets or consulting agreement or protection for your favorite people or health insurance, whatever those oddball things are. But step one is prioritize. What do you want out of this? What's the most important and the least important? Because you're not going to win them all.
Right.
Right. You're going to have to pick and choose. So let's figure out the things we want first. And do that. The second most important thing I would say is you got to be realistic. You know, start a discussion and at some point the client say, well, what are we going to get? I said, well, the first question is who goes first? I said, I want it to be them. Okay. Some people can't help themselves. They want to get a number out. I said, okay, well, where'd you come up with that number? My neighbor's cousin's brother-in-law's fraternity.
Yeah.
A similar business, not really in similar at all, for 8x adjusted earnings.
Right. And
I don't know anything about that business, but I know mine is better, so I want 10.
Right.
Okay. Let's talk about all the assumptions in there, because probably 10 is not the right answer, right? So let's start with expectation. And the third thing I've learned is that selling anything is tricky. And the two things that I try to get clients to accept is, one, you want to have equal power people at the table. And the great example that we're all familiar with is when you go to buy a car, right? So you're in there, you're the buyer, and you're talking to a salesman, and he wants to make a deal that you commit to that he can't. He's going to go talk to the sales manager, right?
Right, right.
So if we're buying or selling a business, if my client is a decision maker, I don't want him at the table unless they're a decision maker, which never is, of course, right?
Right.
They've got a team, or they've got an accountant, or they got a rep. You want equal power at the table so that we don't get boxed into a, if I can get my sales manager, you know, to give you X for your trade-in, and do we have a deal? And Carmine, yeah, I'll do that. He goes back and tells a joke to the sales manager and says, no, my sales manager. So you don't want to put yourself in that position.
Yeah.
If you want to really be smart, you get the opposite. You have your rep talking to their decision maker, and then you can do the conditional, do we have a deal? Second thing, kind of tied to that is, look, your clients, my clients, business owners are strong ego. I can handle it. It's my business. I want to be up. And I try to help clients understand that, again, in a transaction we can all relate to, just sell your house, right? So you have a real estate agent or not. Well, I don't want to pay 5%, 6%, 7%. I will represent myself. I'm going to for sale by owner, right?
Right. How often has that worked?
Never. But because the problem is, it's personal to you. You can't take the emotion out of it. So if it's you and a couple comes through and says, oh my God, green shag? Well, the owner hears, you don't like my taste.
Yeah.
The agent hears, oh, we need a $400 carpet allowance. The agent didn't have the emotion tied to that carpet. They didn't pick it out. They didn't like that color. They don't care. It's a $400 carpet allowance. That's how we solve that problem. But if you're the owner, you go, you don't like my taste? Well, if you don't like my taste, you like my house. I got, you know, memories.
That's real world. That is real world. Yep.
But the same thing happens in business transactions.
Right.
So get someone who's detached, who's not emotional, who's committed, right? So I'm not talking about somebody off the street, but everybody's got a trusted advisor. It's an attorney. It's an accountant. It could be a life insurer. You got a trusted advisor to be that buffer, to get the news, filter it, translate, I don't like that green shag carpet, into they want a $400,000 carpet allowance.
Right. Very good. I want to tell my listeners, I am going to download the notes from this. I'm going to highlight that and put that in my office, the place to start. That's, Dave, that's very good. That's more concise than I have been with folks. I get to the same place. I just do it differently, but I like your conciseness. What's next for you, both personally and professionally?
Well, I'm 63. I kind of always thought I'd work till 70, but I just hit that assets I need to support the lifestyle I want to retire into. Right. So I'm starting to look at succession and exit. I've got a son who's a bright guy, the finance degree, who's working on Wall Street right now. I always kind of thought, you know, I'd kind of turn this over to him.
Right.
He's having a ball. You know, he's working for a brand name outfit on Wall Street. He's living in New York. He's 25 and single, and, you know, life is really good for him. So I'm trying to freshen discussions with him about what that might look like. In the meantime, I'm somewhat actively engaging suitors. There's a lot of consolidation, yes, activity going on in my industry right now. So I'll get a call or email, if not every week, two every 3 weeks. So I'm starting to kind of, you know, engage and see what's what. And part of my problem is, you know, my own list, what's important, starts with my clients are kind of more than my clients. They're all great friends.
Right.
They count on me. I've made promises to them. So objective one for me is, you know, the exact right successor guy, or it could be gal, for them. And I don't need to maximize the sales price. I need to maximize effectiveness of transition.
Right.
But however, and whenever I get that done, on a personal note, I don't know why. I love America. I love America, but I am intrigued by expat life. To live, yes, 6, 9, 12 months, a year,
yep,
some foreign country, learning a new culture,
right,
trying to work on a new language, seeing a part of the world, you know, mm-hmm, in depth and immersing myself in that I haven't lived in before. So I've started exploring.
Interesting.
Expat life. Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Well, I want to say thanks, Dave, for joining us. And how do they find out more about you? How do they go about contacting you? That is, my listeners.
Well, if you remember the last name Enenbach, you do any Google search for Enenbach, spelled the standard way. I stole that from Joe Hersteiner, but it's E-N-E-N-B-A-C-H. You Google Enenbach, you're either going to find me or a relative, or if you can remember www.enenbachconsulting, that's our website. It's got email and phone information. I'm not hard to find if you can just remember Enenbach.
Thanks, Dave. If you're in search of assistance with your business, go to davesider.com and schedule a free consultation. Also, if you would, make sure to subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave me a comment at your favorite podcast platform such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And I thank Dave, and I thank you all for listening in. Stay tuned for our next scheduled podcast. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, please, each and every business owner should consult with their attorney or trusted advisor on their distinct circumstances.